It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Captain John Havlick, retired U.S. Navy, led special operation teams around the world during his 31-year naval career, including the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, the SEAL's most elite operation unit. Captain Havlick was a nationally ranked swimmer and is a member of the West Virginia University Sports Hall of Fame and Mountaineer Legends Society. I'm excited to have him on the show. Please welcome Captain John Havlick. Welcome.
Bert, thanks for having me on today. Appreciate it.
You bet. Well, first of all, thank you for serving our country for 31 years. That is a huge amount of time, so thank you so much.
My pleasure. Absolutely. I enjoyed doing it.
Well, all right. So let's talk about this. Today, we're going to be talking about your latest book. You co-wrote this book with Bill Treasure. Is that right? Bill Treasure?
Yep, that's correct.
Yep. And the book, and I like this, The Leadership Killer. The Leadership Killer, Reclaiming Humility in an Age of Arrogance. And it seems like we are kind of in an age of arrogance. And it seems like, at least in the reality show and in a lot of the media, it seems like arrogant people seem to get a lot of attention. What's going on?
Yeah, I guess drama sells. I don't get it, but it just seems that the more cockier, the louder you are, I guess the more squeaky the wheel, the more attention you get, and the more people listen to you. So that was kind of a little bit behind the book Bill and I wrote, and a little bit of the theme of what we come up with when we were talking about, you know, how are we going to approach this topic and what are we going to look at?
Well, you know, what's interesting, and the reason that the title resonated with me, when I look back at all of my biggest mistakes that I have ever made, you know, ego, arrogance, pride, whatever you want to call it, was there. I mean, I just look back and I'm going, I don't know what I was thinking. I just, you know, you start to believe your own press clippings, you start to believe, you know, these voices in your head, and before you realize that you're making these mistakes that are going to cost you, you know, possibly a career or a bunch of money or a loved one, or in some cases, people cross the line and it costs them their freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really easy to get enticed or get spoiled by the power of leadership. And I, case in point, you know, the book, two chapters of it is about my own hubristic fall from grace, so to speak, and how I recovered. And actually, what I learned from it when I reached my rock bottom was, you know, I felt I became a better, more effective leader because I had hit the bottom. And when I got the second chance, I was more appreciative of the opportunities that I had. And so I took advantage of that. But yes, it's very, very, you know, give you rise up the corporate ladder, you are the promotion ladder, so to speak, you tend to, you know, after time, you're like, well, I must be important because they wouldn't have made me commanding officer or whatever, CEO, however you want to look at it.
Right.
And then more people respond to you. And we often say you get the better office, you get the premier parking spot, you know, you get the more windows in the office and more people, you know, kind of at your beck and call to help you out. And you can tend to forget about where you came from, your roots, what got you there. The fundamentals of leadership can be swayed towards, say, I want more because it feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let me ask you this. I asked this of all the authors that stopped by here, and that is, what inspired you and Bill to write this book?
Well, you know, when I retired, Bill, I guess the long story is Bill and I, the commonality we have is we both went to West Virginia University, and he was a diver and I was a swimmer. So I met him when he was a freshman. I was finishing up my degree and I was coaching. And so we kind of just formed a bond and friends until I graduated and went off and did a bunch of other stuff. And then Bill went off and did his thing. And so we reunited a few years back at a reunion. And Bill had his Giant Leap Consulting firm, and I did some research, and I said, "Hey, Bill, you should bring me in. Let me tell my sea stories. You know, it seems like everybody wants SEAL stories." So he's been real good, and we struck the friendship back up again. And I've been able to sponsor or tell kind of my SEAL stories and about leadership with him at seminars across the country. We've co-facilitated workshops. And so we've built a working relationship over the last few years and a good friendship. And, you know, just seemed like every week we would just share articles with each other on leaders who did stupid things that clearly they know they stepped over the line and should have known better. And, you know, Bill just kind of mentioned one day, hey, I'd like to write a book, my fifth book. And I said, "Well, that's cool." He goes, "You want a co-author?" And I go, "Sure, yeah." So I was like, "Why not?" You know, never thought I'd do it. So I just, you know, that started the momentum. And then as we started writing, you know, we went big picture, like we were identifying all these different traits and what's bad leadership and things like that. And we just kind of over time, every Sunday we would talk, and we would kind of whittled it down to, this term hubris, kind of in excessive arrogance or self-confidence. And it just seemed to me that when we talked about it, that was the character trait. That was really the root of all the other ones. And so if you were hubristic, you tended to be self-serving, less caring of others, all more about results and things like that. And so that was the basis of the book. And we wanted to focus it on, because hubris was a topic no one was talking about. Even right. when the word came up, I had to look it up to make sure that I understood what we were going to write about. But it seemed very relevant at the time. So that's the theory behind, that's how we got together. And that's the basis of the book.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great topic because it is just one of the human frailties of life, right? I mean, it's just one of those things when a human starts to be successful or to start to gain power, however you want to phrase it, that pride seems to creep in. And I think that true leaders are able to overcome that arrogance, that pride, that hubris. And that's why I think sometimes some of our best leaders tend to be older guys or older people, both men and women, just because, just like your story, right? You've been to the top, and then then we all fall to the bottom.
Yeah.
And we're never so coachable or teachable as when we're at that bottom place.
Well, I think, I think the big thing that I found, especially with my story, is, and I think it relates to a lot of things, is when you're hubristic, you think you know it all. And whether you're a young, college graduate or a young professional or an older leader, over time, you tend to think you know it all. And that's when really hubris kind of strikes. Because in reality, if you're a leader and you think you know it all, you really don't. And so one of the things I learned very quickly, it was kind of highlighted in SEAL training, was I had to learn from my men, especially as an officer, because they had all the experience and the knowledge that I needed to make the right decisions. And so that's where I think hubris really comes into play the most, is the leaders who think they know it all. And I think we're seeing a lot of that right now as we face this pandemic. So,
yeah, it's amazing. There is, I cannot remember his name now, but he became famous overnight. I think it's Skrill, Elliot Skrill or Shrill HIV meds, and raised the price like 1,000% from a couple of dollars to like $800 a tablet or whatever it was. It made, headline news. And of course, he comes across as a pretty arrogant guy. He says, look, it's my company. I do whatever I want. And of course, he had not done anything illegal. Definitely some might question the morality of it, but legally speaking, he had done everything within the bounds of the law. But interestingly enough, like 30, maybe 60 days later, he was arrested for insider trading.
Yeah.
He painted this target on his back, and you know, they couldn't get him one way. It seems like they got him another way. But that's the kind of arrogance that just really rubs people the wrong way.
Well, I can only speak a lot of it from my military side of the house, but you know, when I got a commanding officer position, the Navy trains you, they send you to school, and they clearly bring their lawyers in and they give highlights or lowlights of commanding officers who did stupid things and crossed the line and ended up being relieved from their assignment, which is, I can't think of anything worse in life than being relieved of being in charge. And so, but you learn from that. And I think what really where hubris kind of comes into play is you tend to think that you get up there and nobody's going to say anything or nobody notices. And which is clearly a hubristic thought on your part, because everybody sees what's going on. Everybody can tell what's going on. And, you know, if you're crossing the line, you're doing it wrong, then you got to have people who are going to call you out. And so that's kind of what I saw on the hubristic side of the house in the military.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and there's a fine line too, John, between confidence.
Absolutely.
And arrogance, because yeah. There are some people who are extremely confident. But again, there's that fine line, which is, I think, tough to navigate. You know, you can easily cross it. But yeah, there is that fine line. I think that confidence is important. Being arrogant, prideful, definitely going to lead you down the path of destruction.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you're right. Cause a lot of times people will ask me when I'm talking, it's like, you know, what's the difference? And there's a fine line there truly is. And I think to be successful, whether you're an athlete or a business, you know, whatever profession you're in to be good at it, you have to have self-confidence. And I think there is and this is what kind of relates to my current doctoral status as a student is I actually think there's some positive traits to hubris that should be explored or researched a little bit more. And that's kind of way I'm leaning my dissertation right now, unless somebody talks me out of it. But I think there is a point, you know, and I relate it basically to my time as an athlete, my time as a coach, and then in the SEALs, you know, clearly there was something that separated the successful folks from the ones that weren't so successful. And I saw it a lot in SEAL training of the guys who made it through training and those who didn't. You know, there were clearly, I don't know if it was self-confidence, but it just seemed to this aspect of, you know, just throw it at me, I'll take it, you know, and I'll go on, march on and do it, you know. And I think that's a little hubristic thought, and that's why I kind of leaning towards this positive side of hubris, and hopefully maybe that's my dissertation and maybe my next book, so to speak. We'll see. But
well, you know what? And I like that because it is true. I mean, look, somebody with a big ego wants to take on that role. They want to show off the fact that they can overcome this obstacle. So there is that that positive side to it. It's not all bad. It's just, you know, it's I think it becomes bad when you put other people at risk, or you put maybe your company at risk, your family at risk. But I think that when you look around, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, Warren Buffett comes across as a pretty humble guy, but I bet you he's got an ego. He is what, the fourth or fifth or sixth richest man in the world. And he is by, you know, he I think has a good grip of his ego. Again, I've never seen an interview where he comes across as anything more than a nice guy who's very grateful for his success, but yet you know, he's Warren Buffett. He's got to have a certain level of ego. He's probably forgotten more about trading and investing than I'll ever know.
Yeah. Well, that's clearly that applies to me. So I think being a good leader, whether it's confidence or hubris, you have to make a decision. There comes a time when you have to make a decision. Yes. And you have to have the confidence to make that decision and hope you're doing it for the right reasons. And so, that comes with being a leader. You know, the instructors told us at SEAL school, especially the officers, was the guys want you to make a decision. You can't waffle. You can't put it off. You can't pass it down. You're in charge. You have to make the decision. And I think whether you define that as self-confidence, hubris, however you want to look at it, as a leader, you are required to make a decision. And so that's the positive side that I look at it. But I'm sure there's a lot out there that will argue the contrary to that. So, yes. Yeah, so. So well, I need a lot of data for my research.
There you go. Well, you know what? And again, not to be political, I think that our current president is a good example of, you know, certainly a gentleman who has a lot of confidence. He's not afraid to make a decision. Definitely, at sometimes he comes across as arrogant or cocky. And then other times he comes across as a guy who is being things are uncertain. And so I think people look to that as a form of leadership. If my leader thinks this is going to be okay, then it must be okay. So I think that, he's a kind of a live example to help us understand a little bit more about humanity. But let me ask you this. I want to move on. In the book, again, I want to pop this up here real quick. The book is called The Leadership Killer, Reclaiming Humility in the Age of Arrogance. So in the book, give me your takeaways, the three takeaways, how to remain humble yet effective leader, because it seems almost, again, that's a tough line to walk. So talk about this.
Well, three things we offered up, Bill and I kind of came up were, you know, the first thing and biggest leadership lesson I ever learned was to push away from my desk, to get out of my office, and to walk around and talk to my people. And it was something I learned very early on in my military career was really the, I started hearing, I was in a leadership position. And I started hearing rumors through in the Navy. God, I've already done. It's embarrassing. But the rumors was that leadership at this command didn't know what was going on. And I started hearing that. And I remember saying that when I was a young junior officer. But now I was in the leadership position, they're saying about me. So, you know, how can I make myself more knowledgeable? And to know what's going on around the command. So I took an opportunity every week to walk around the command. It was my job to make sure spaces were cleaned before everybody took off for weekend liberty. And I used that time to, check for cleanliness, but I also took the opportunity to talk with my people. And it was really, it was hard because in the beginning, it was hard for me because I'm kind of quiet. Took me a lot for me to open up, to put myself, kind of expose myself out there to feedback. And it was hard for the people to kind of grasp this, but the aspect that I was down there to listen and learn from them, which isn't always true in a lot of cases. It took time. It took a commitment on my part, and I did it every week. And I just didn't do it once every now and then. And like a checkoff. I did it every week. I made a commitment and I opened myself up and I listened and I learned so much and really helped. Every time I hear this term cultural change, there were some things that we were trying to implement the commanding officer and I, and we used it a great opportunity to communicate our message, what we wanted to do, get the feedback from the people actually on the deck plate or the production floor doing the actual work? How could it be successful? What's wrong? What are your two cents? So that was the best thing I ever did. Get out of my office, go down, talk and meet with your people. The second one was, I think we mentioned earlier, if you think you know it all, then you're really fooling yourself. And so another great opportunity walking around was, again, learning what I didn't know. And I was pretty amazed at how much I didn't know. And so I took it as an opportunity to grow and to learn. And I think that people appreciate the opportunity to teach the boss, you know, or appreciate the fact that they were asking me my opinion, and they seem very real about it and honest about it, and got good feedback. And then the one thing I try to highlight in my story of hubris and my downfall was I got very cocky after I came out of SEAL training. Go figure that one. And I thought I knew it all. And I failed to get a mentor, or what they call in the Navy, a sea daddy, and somebody to bounce ideas off, get career advice, just somebody that could add a little sanity check to the way I was thinking. And I thought I could do it all. And it burned me pretty good. And so we offer up the third tip is, you know, have a check. Have somebody in your life, whether it's your significant other, somebody at work, somebody that you can trust, that has that outlet to give you open and honest feedback and to kind of call you out when you're stepping over the line, getting a little hubristic, so to speak. So those are the three things we offer up.
Yeah, I like that. Let me tell you, there is nothing better than to have your spouse bring you back to earth.
Yes. Or a room full of SEALs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned very on, you know, as a junior officer, you gotta have a thick skin walking into a platoon space full of SEALs. You know, they will call you out in a minute. So yeah. It's very humbling.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? And it's interesting that those three takeaways, those three strategies, if you will, really can be done anywhere by anybody at any time. Mm-hmm. They don't require really any kind of technology or any, you know, necessarily a high level of experience. It's, you know, your willingness to go out and talk with the frontline troops or just walk through the office and find out what people are thinking, what are their likes and dislikes. Not only do you find out what people are talking about, but you get to know them. And we, you know, we're as humans go, we tend to be pretty simple in the sense that we tend to like people that are like us. So what better way for people to get to know you like you than to go out there and get to know them?
Yeah, that was best thing I ever did. And it's something that I tried to apply as I continued on in my career. But it was, you know, right up front again, I'll say it's extremely difficult because you have to open yourself up. You have to kind of be vulnerable because you're not always going to get positive feedback. And, you know, you gotta take it in stride. But in reality, when I made, you know, I think people appreciated the fact that I made the commitment, I was taking my time, and that I was going and talking to them directly, eye to eye, not in a formal setting where I'm talking down to people. I was talking with them and at them, you know, and I thought it was, it was very rewarding after a couple months when I would walk into a space or office space that they didn't run away. They actually stayed and wanted to talk to me, because in reality, when the executive officer, which was my job at the time, is walking around the command, it's usually for the wrong reasons. It's never good. But over time, they learned this as, hey, the XO's here. They knew I was coming down on Fridays. And this was their opportunity to talk and just, you know, and it was great to know them. I shook their hand. I tried to learn their first name, to ask them about their families, because it was an overseas assignment. Overseas assignments are very difficult on family members. And so the more you know about your command, the more you know about your people, the more appreciative they are and the better job they'll do for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Feeling appreciated is definitely one of the things that makes a group stick together. I think putting people down and making them feel unappreciated is a great way to disband any group, right? I think humility is, again, one of those things that it's a binding agent. And then pride is definitely something that will separate you and separate your group. All right, so you kind of made this reference to your specific situation in the SEALs, and in the book you talk about really leaving SEALs, if I understand it correctly, because of not being able to be promoted anymore. Is that right? Talk about this.
Yeah, it was very humbling and very embarrassing on my part. I had done all the good stuff, took the hard jobs, thought I was doing the right stuff, and because I had didn't have a mentor, and I thought I knew it all, I got very cocky and tried to do things my way, and I probably stepped on some toes and upset a few people, and I kind of got burned, and so I didn't promote twice, which was pretty shocking on my part, and I had to get out of the Navy. I had to get out, stop being a SEAL, and that was real hard because I loved being a SEAL. I loved being in the Navy. I loved the idea of defending your country is very honorable to me, and so I enjoyed my military time, and when it was taken away from me, it hurt, and it hit me hard. And so I had to take the time, my time off, I got to a very dark place, and I wasn't a very good person. And I started drinking. I started doing a bunch of other stuff, nothing really healthy. And I became a bad person. So I kind of figured out what was going on and made it a point to get back in because I wanted to prove everybody wrong, and I wanted to be a SEAL again. And so it took me time, but it took some time to do it, to figure it through, go through the system, but eventually got it and worked it back out. But it was a huge humbling experience drawn upon because of my own hubristic behavior.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Humbling yourself enough to go back after, again, to no promote, that is difficult. But yet, to me, this is a guy who wants it bad enough, who's humbled himself. He's now coachable. To me, this is one of the leadership principles that people like to see in other humans.
Well, I got humbled. That was, yeah. So it was a big ego shot to me in the gut, so sure, to speak. But but I learned when I got my second opportunity, I was so appreciative of being back in the Navy, and I didn't know how much I missed it until I got out. But even getting back in, every day for the rest of my career, I had to reprove myself and my credibility within the community. So it kept me on my toes, and it kept me productive, kept me on top of my game. But it was a hard lesson learned, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody out there.
Yeah. The book, again, is called The Leadership Killer, Reclaiming Humility in the Age of Arrogance. My guest today is Captain John Havlick, U.S. Navy SEAL, retired. But John, what's interesting is you don't go by Captain. You actually prefer to go by Coach. Why is that?
It's a nickname I got the first day of training. I originally got in the Navy to coach swimming at the Naval Academy. And then when I was at the Academy, I learned about the SEALs and took the opportunity and contacts there to get my commission, and then with a guarantee to go on to SEAL training after I got commissioned. And so I always remember first day of training, my leading petty officer, the most senior guy in our class, he was walking around the officers introducing themselves, and And he goes, "Hey, what's your name, Ensign?" And I said, "It's Coach Havlik." And he goes, "Well, what'd you do beforehand?" And I said, "I coached swimming at the academy." And he goes, "Yeah, I think Coach is better than Ensign. Is that okay?" And I said, "Yeah, that's fine." And so that carried on, that nickname carried on throughout my career. Even as I got promoted and changed ranks and doing the other stuff. If you talk to anybody who knows me, I don't think they know my first name. So traditionally, yeah, most of the people in the SEALs that are still around or know me as Coach. And I responded well to it because I always thought Coach was a moniker of respect, somebody that you looked up to. And I was okay with it. You know, so whether the guys were calling me Coach or a senior leader was calling me Coach, I was okay with it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And I cannot remember what company I read about this, but they have changed the name. Instead of using the name manager or supervisor, now their title is coach and head coach, because their culture shift, kind of what you were talking about earlier, that mind shift is that, you know, that's truly what a supervisor or a manager should be, is they're coaching their people up. So they're getting them ready for the next play or, you know, however you want to phrase that. But I really like that, because as you said, coach is one of those monikers that is both about the leader, that's the coach, and the guy that we love or the girl that we love, that's the coach. You know, so this coach is a very special name, and it's not rewarded, if you will, to just anybody.
Yeah. I even my coach in college to this day, he always says, you know, call me Kevin. And I'm like, okay, coach. But, you know, so I can't do it. I can't do it because I know what we went through together, and he was a great influencer in my life. So when that came into the teams, I thought it was the perfect moniker. So yeah. if I was good with it, you know, instructors would yell at me, you know, and they wouldn't call me Ensign. They'd call me coach, you know, you're messing up coach and other terms, so to speak, right. other language. But no, I thought it was good. I mean, a coach, you're there. You earn that title for a reason, and it comes with high expectations. And so to me, it's always been a term of endearment, term of respect, and I was okay with it.
Sure, absolutely. All right, so let's talk about this. You know, what would you have done differently when you were a young junior officer in the Naval Academy or in the SEALs? Talk about this.
I think it kind of comes point to that last point I brought up about the three takeaways, so to speak, was there's really two answers to that. First one is to be a mentor, kid, find a mentor, a sea daddy. And I think I explained that long enough. Somebody that can give you career advice, or at least a sounding board as you go through life or whatever you're going to do in your profession, whatever profession you choose, have somebody there that you can call upon and will give you honest feedback. And then, I forgot what the second one is. So, I think the big thing was I didn't know everything. And then the other thing I wasn't good at is I wasn't very good at politics. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't smart on office politics. And so I quickly found out that the strongest, the smartest, the bravest, the biggest don't always get it promoted or advanced. And it's often who you know. That's how you play the game. And I didn't do that very well. And I kind of take that back to my swimming background, where I was just used to, you know, you get up on the blocks and your competitors are up there and you have a known race or a known distance. And it's usually the person that's worked the hardest or wants it the most that's the winner. And I kind of found out very quickly that I I wasn't very smart on politics.
Right.
And so I kind of got burned. But again, when I got back in, I got smart on it. I knew I was bad at it and I knew I was weak at it. So I had to get smart on it. And eventually, you kind of learn how to use it towards your advantage if you're smart about it. But it took a real hard lesson learned to get that. So the two things I would do differently as a junior officer was find a mentor and then at least know about office politics.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And this is vitally important. Great tips, by the way. People tend to promote those people that, again, they know, like, and trust. And you might be the best, but if you aren't well-liked, if you're rubbing people the wrong way, you won't be promoted because, you know, people skills is, in fact, a very important hard skill. You know, again, you show me somebody that that carries a lot of influence, and you'll see somebody that's got some, you know, fairly good people skills. They're able to get people excited about their vision. They're able to rally the troops, and it's extremely important. I mean, you know, I think those are significant. All right, so so now you and Bill, or is it just you? I mean, do you work? Now, if somebody goes out to coachhavlick.com and people hire you to do what besides speaking, what else do you do?
I do counseling, consultant work, pretty much open. I don't have a, you know, I'm trying to enjoy retirement, so to speak. But and now that I'm a student, again, that's taking a lot of my time. But I just try to, I try to offer up advice, maybe a consulting type work, sure. Help you out to think kind of an outside set of eyes, you know. There's one thing we really learn in the military is how to tear things apart, you know, especially mission planning and stuff like that. So I like to come in as somebody, I may not know your business, but I got a lot of questions, you know, and it's always kind of, I always think it's very good to bring an outside set of eyes who has no vested interest to kind of what we would call a red cell it, to tear the part, to look at the things that not everybody's looking at or maybe afraid to look at, and just bring it up so that, you know, you address them and know that they're out there. And so I do that. The big thing I've been doing is a lot of individual coaching and counseling, you know, hour sessions on the phone. I just worked with a guy up and changed jobs in the IT world. And then we talked about him taking over and doing a process of in place. And this pandemic hit and hit his business hard.
Sure.
But he is still employed because he, I'd like to think he did some good stuff. Some of the things, some lessons we talked about on how to take over and how to show positivity and productivity and even times of crisis, and he's doing real well. So I just try to open up, share my experiences, what I did right and wrong, just the bevy of whatever you want. I'm a jack of all trades right now. So
all right, you know what? And it's so important. I like this idea. This to me, again, it's a very, very difficult thing for most people to do, is have somebody with a, like you said, a third set of eyes come in and start poking holes. Because again, I'll just say arrogance. You know, if you're an arrogant person, you don't want your holes poked.
Yeah.
You don't want somebody showing you your flaws, as opposed to, back to your three takeaways, when you're open to learning, when you want that feedback from your peers, and you're kind of a coachable person, then you want that third set of eyes to come in and say, hey, John, did you think about this? What happens if this happens? You know, what if these assumptions aren't true? Then what's your B plan? And that's the difference, I think, between a company that's going to be around for a while and a company that's going to just, you know, crash and burn.
Yeah, I from the outside, I you know, I'm not sure a lot of businesses have strategic planning. And right. So, you know, long term, and I'm not a businessman, so you can take that for whatever it's worth. But I know in the military, and what we learned very, especially on mission planning, is we what if'd our operation to death, you know. So we tried to keep it simple, but we also thought about all the things that could go wrong to the best of the ability, and then come up with courses of action. If in the event that they did happen, you can't think of everything,
right?
But you can think of some big ticket events that could really mess things up. And so what that does in some regards is it helps you plan for worst case scenario, something that, hey, we've already thought about this and this is what we're going to do. And it can respond and then hopefully get out of danger if something comes up and then make the decision. Can we go on or do we have to abort the mission? You know, because, and as a leader, it was my job to make sure they did that, because worst case scenario, if something happened to me and they're left, they have to be able to make a decision and carry on. So I was really happy with the way the military, we planned what if everything to death. And I don't see a lot of that in the business world. And I, hopefully I'm wrong, but right now I don't see that too much. And so that's that'd be my regard is, you know, plan, look. But what I think would also helps out, yes, you have to have a thin skin. No leader wants somebody coming in tearing your plan apart when you think it's good. But right. if you're open minded, it can also reinforce some things that you're doing right, and you can highlight. They can highlight that, and so it gives you points to consider, and whether you take it into consideration or not. That's totally the leader's call. But I think having an unbiased set of eyes to look at your plan, especially long-term, is really kind of beneficial to businesses for success.
Absolutely. John, we're out of time. I want to say thank you so much for stopping by. The book again, The Leadership Killer, Reclaiming Humility in an Age of Arrogance, Captain John Havlick, retired Navy SEAL. Thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to catching up with you again.
Thanks, Bert. Appreciate the opportunity. Stay safe, everybody.
We'll see you later.
All right.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.